Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead, and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, the John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies. If only he'd use them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry in an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number 1, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. survivor, mother, leader, and humanity's last chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Samuel Shem on the show with me today. He's the author of the brand new follow-up to the blockbuster hit The House of God. The new book is called Man's Fourth Best Hospital, and this is a stunning read. Welcome to the show, Shem.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow. I'm not sure. I had a kind of the standard miserable growing up, and I think in retrospect I realized I always wanted to do something creative, artistic, and I fitzed around with a bunch of different things. I guess what comes to me right now, although I didn't ever make it into wanting to be a writer, I had terrible education, terrible teachers, except for one who was in high school, was the English teacher. And for the first time ever, I was a big reader, but I used to read crap. And for the first time ever, I heard of someone I had hardly heard about. It was very unread. Shakespeare. It just blew me away. And so I think I always wanted, I sort of started me thinking I want to be a writer. Maybe I want to write something, but I was never encouraged for that. My father was a firstborn in this country a dentist. He wanted to be a doctor, but he didn't get into NYU med school, any NYU med schools, because of the Jewish quota. So he, instilled in me that I had to be a doctor. And the interesting thing was that somehow or other, when I got into Harvard for my sports, I think, and when I got to Harvard, I wrote down on my little note on the freshman yearbook what you wanted to be, and I wanted to be a writer. So I don't know how that all came together. I hadn't written anything. So then things got interesting and worse. Everybody had to take a writing course, right? In little seminars. Every freshman had to take a seminar on writing, right? So here I am wanting to be a writer, and I worked like hell on my first essay, handed it in, got it back from the teacher, and there wasn't a mark on it. But then I looked more carefully, and down at the bottom in little red letters was "See me." So I thought, oh, she wants to congratulate me. I'll go. So naive. You have no idea, Hank. So I show up, and this is, I'm from a small town. This is the word from this huge institution that I was scared to hell of on my chosen future profession of a writer. And she said, quote, "This essay is too terrible to mark."
Oh, she my says, goodness.
It's below F. And I got to admit it, I started to cry, Tears came to my eyes. And, so it went on like that. She kept on giving me, below F, below F, below F. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And, the one thing I realized is I could be a lot of things in my life for a job, but the one thing I could not be was a writer. So for 4 years, I didn't write a word. I did a lot of other things, so I didn't write a word. Oh, and I was on the golf team, and that spring, toward the end of the year, I was playing golf with a guy who was in the same seminar, had the same teacher, and he was really stupid, and from Florida, he was a swimmer. That's why he got into Harvard. He's really dumb, and he said to me at one point in the golf match, he said, I'm getting a straight A in that course, and I'm still down near D. Great job, And I said, "What, you?" He said, "Yeah, I've been sleeping with her all year."
Oh, mercy.
He was this blonde Adonis type, and I said, "Oh, well, maybe this is a lesson about writing, I don't know." So then I got lucky. I didn't write a word at Harvard, but I happened to get a Rhodes Scholarship, and I got to Oxford, and I looked over my shoulder, and I said, she can't get me now. And so I started writing, and I just wrote. I loved it. I loved writing. And I had a kind of an epiphany in the Sahara Desert and all that stuff. And then the next important piece of becoming a writer, I was 3 years at Oxford. That was 1969. And all of a sudden, I got a kind of interesting note, which basically said I had a choice between Vietnam or Harvard Medical School. And I thought, well, I don't want to get killed or kill somebody. I want to cure them. So I went to Harvard Medical School with the vision that I would continue to try to be a writer. I'd never tried to publish anything, but I would continue to write. But I would have a day job that I could use all over the world. A doctor can be employed all over the world. That was a very smart, because I didn't want to write for money. I really didn't. I was a purist, really. And I said, and so that's what, and then I went to medical school, and then the last challenge, actually, was, what kind of practice I would go into as a doctor, and I didn't know what would give me time, and then finally, I came to psychiatry, and I said, hey, wait a second, you learn about people, you learn character, plus I have mornings free to write before I go see patients. So I jumped into that psychiatry for that. And, of course, the irony of all of this is that if I hadn't gone to medical school and if I hadn't actually gone to the Beth Israel Hospital, which was crazy in those days, where I wanted to go to a different one, I would never have become a writer, I wouldn't have had anything to write about.
Really. Well, and it was those experiences at Beth Israel as an intern that you started writing down just as a catharsis. Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right. I just actually, if anybody's interested, including you, you should go to mansforthbesthospital.com because. We told that story, and we got together after the year was over, and we'd get together the five guys I was closest with: Eat My Dust Eddie and Hyper Hooper and the Runt and others, and just get drunk and smoke and talk. And I sort of transcribed some of it, and then I said, "Hey, what the hell? I didn't even think of writing a book. I just started to write something in prose about those moments. And I never thought to publish it. I was interested in plays. So here's the next amazing thing. I was looking for a play agent. I had started my psychiatry training at a big mental hospital called McLean of Harvard. And I wrote off to a play agent, I've got a play, a couple of plays, maybe you'd like to look at them. And she wrote back and said, well, you also wrote at the bottom that you have a start of a doctor novel. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, right. And she said, I don't do fiction. I don't do plays, but I do fiction. Why don't you send me what you got? And I had, you know, I mean, I didn't know you were supposed to double space things. It had cigarette butts, you know, pipe, booze, you know, all over it, rings of booze. I forgot about it. This is a true story. So I forgot about it. Then about 10 days later, I'm in the secretary's pool at the McLean Hospital. And I get a call from her. I'd forgotten her name, actually. And she said, well, I don't know if you're a madman or a genius, but I really like what you sent me. And I actually had the presence to say, well, I can't help you there, but you should know that I'm speaking to you from within a large mental hospital at this time. And that started it. That started it. And seven drafts later, it was a book.
That book, which was The House of God, went on to be a blockbuster success and very influential, not only in the eyes of your colleagues and peers, but it really opened a window to the layman to really understand what was going on in the medical profession the doctor's training and all of that. Were you prepared in any way for the feedback that you would get on that book and what a cultural touchstone it became?
No. I wasn't even too interested in it, in a way. I mean, I loved that I had done it, but I was sort of interested in plays then, and all I knew... Well, actually, see, I don't run on fear. I run on guilt, you know. Well, I didn't worry because I knew. It's really a wonderful, I have the same feeling with Man's Fourth Best Hospital now, thank God. I've told the truth with a lot of laughter and a lot of humor, and in the House of God, especially with a lot of sex. And how could they not? I thought everybody was going to love it, you know. Well, My generation absolutely loved it. It had terrible publishing history. They didn't believe in the book. They had a terrible publishing history. But my guys just, it flew out of the stores for my guys. And I got really ravaged by the older generation, you know, really nasty. They did nasty stuff, tried to do even more nasty stuff. But I, you know, I was full of confidence. And I'll tell you, the next step in this that gave me a sense of this being something other than just kind of the story of the year, I was a real purist as a writer. You know, I'd read all the classics, all the Irish, everybody. I was a Beckett fan for a while and a Joyce and I read everything at Oxford, which I'd never read much at all in this little town I grew up in, Hudson, New York. And I'm just trying to remember where I was going with it, with the House of God. Oh, I know, got it. I decided that I would not go out and make any appearances for the book. I thought that was sort of vulgar. And I had taken a pen name to protect my patients from them knowing I was a writer as a psychiatrist. I thought it might cause trouble. It didn't. They all found out. But I refused all invitations for 2 years. I didn't go out and say that nobody could find me. I didn't do any appearances for 2 years. So the book was just out there. And then one day I got a letter from my publisher. And it said, I'm on call all night in a VA hospital in Tulsa. And if it weren't for your book, I'd kill myself. And I had the reaction you just had. It hit me in the gut and I said, oh my God, And I thought, maybe I have something to say that will help. And this was the start. And so I then started going out, and what I basically now I can talk about, I didn't know what I was doing, but I can talk about it. I write fictions of resistance, right? So I write when I, you know, I say to myself, hey, wait a second, this is something unjust. And what I say is, what I talk about is how to stay human in medicine, the danger of isolation and the healing power of good connection. And that's what I've done for the last 40 years. And you know what? Now that book sells more than ever. It's, you know, my teaching at NYU of these kids, these children, and this NYU seminar on the House of God, they are riveted to that story. Everything's changed in medicine, but the feelings haven't changed. And that's why I have hope. Maybe we can turn to Nance Forth. That's why I have hope for Nance Forth Best Hospital, because I know, I'm just as sure as I was with the House of, I've captured a moment in a crisis, not just in training, it's far broader than that, in the whole medical system and how it is worse for doctors, worse for patients, worse for nation, for nurses, etc. And I'm going out for this one, you know, to talk about it, because this is pretty terrible right now. You know.
Well, let's talk about it just a minute. The characters that you created in the House of God were so relatable. I think one of the reasons that book was such a success is that we could see these people that I think most laymen would hold doctors to a higher esteem, and they seemed to be other people than the rest of us. Yet in the House of God, they were all these were people we could connect with. They were like us, but in a different circumstance. And I'm sure people for years clamored, you know, that they would love to see more from these characters. And you didn't write more about these characters for nearly 40 years. What was it that that gave you the feeling that you could now speak to more story for these characters?
Well, yeah. I always wanted to write a sequel, but I was out of medicine. You know, I was basically writing, doing that, a few other things. And so I didn't have anything to write about. I always wanted to. I really wanted to. I said, I'd love to do this again, that book. And then all of a sudden, this is the way life is, right, Hank? The butterfly went one way, and I, out of the blue, I get a call from New York University Medical School. And they say, hey, you want to be a professor in medical humanities at NYU? I say, why? He said, well, to teach. And I said, well, teach what? He said, teach the House of God. And Harvard hated me for the House of God. And they loved me from the House of God. And so I went, and I had this epiphany because I was back into modern medicine all of a sudden. And I saw the wonders of it. I won't go through those now, the wonders of it. And then I saw, you know, something that was this first time I was on the wards, these hey, wait a second moments. And as the narrator says at the beginning of the book, Roy Bash, it's the same narrator, he says, he says, I'm called, use that word, I think he said that, called to write this novel, Nance Forth, because I am writing about a time when medicine could go one of two ways, either toward more humane care or toward money and screens, meaning computer screens. And then he says, which is money and money. So what I saw when I got back into medicine, and this book is not about NYU Med, it's too good a place, but when I went back into medicine, I saw very clearly, just perfectly, I said, hey, somebody got to write about this, and I guess it's going to be you. And it's, you know, the money is, you know, basically about the for-profit insurance thing, and the screens are billing screens. They're cash registers. The public doesn't know this, that when your doctor is at the screen, they think it's better for your care. It's not. he or she has his back to you because he has to spend 60 or 70% of his time clicking boxes to pay the insurance industry. And there's a war, I realized very quickly, there's a war going on across that computer screen. On the doctor side, we are forced to try to bill for the most. And on the insurance side, they're trying to pay the least. And like all wars, I love this line in the book, like all wars, it's about money. And that's what's happened. And that has to change, and I do believe it will change. The fat man, of course, is onto this. And the book, if I can just quickly say what it's about. Yeah, the fat man is called back to a hospital called Man's Fourth Best Hospital to fix it, because it used to be Man's First Best Hospital. And he's rich and famous, so they need him because their prestige is down and they're going broke. And he's gotten rich in Silicon Valley too, by discovering a pill that will help memory in old people and gomers. So he comes back and he can do whatever he wants. And what he wants to do is to bring the gang together again and add a lot of women, because women weren't in it in those days. So there's parity with women in this. He wants to start a public outpatient clinic. He treats the public. Up against this huge skyscraper of Man's Fourth, and his goal is to put the human back into medicine. He wants to do it right. And that's the story. That's what happens. And he comes up, and it's a novel of resistance again, because he comes up against the injustice for doctors, nurses, patients, etc. And it's about what I've already said. It's about the for-profit insurance agency. He gives a lecture called The Six Rackets of American Healthcare. Excuse me. Follow the Money. And it took me about 2 months to figure this out, the six different ones intertwined. And then he gives a solution to make this better at the end. And the solution, basically, in one phrase, he says, you got to squeeze the money out of the machines. And I can talk more about that in terms of a real healthcare proposal that would work in the United States.
Well, what I was surprised in reading the book is that I could see my experiences with doctors in the recent past. And I was, nodding my head along, yes, this has been my experience. I know why the doctor doesn't seem to be paying any attention to what I'm telling him or her. They're just clicking away and, as I'm trying to talk to them. And I realize what's going on behind the screen. It also made me realize that for all of the conversations that we have about healthcare reform, it seems like none of them are actually going for what the actual problem is. And we're all trying to fix pieces of a broken system, but we're not getting to the root of it. We're treating symptoms of a broken system. We can have those conversations, and you can tell us all day long that the problem is money and how we've exalted the insurance companies into the healthcare system and all of this, and we can make an academic pitch for that. But a novel is so much more powerful in changing our perceptions and giving us a emotional connection to the problem and to the solution. Why do you think it is that the form of the novel is so powerful in changing the way we think and feel about things?
Well, bless you, Hank. I mean, you've said everything that I would like said about this book right there. Fiction, Lincoln said, about Uncle Tom's Cabin, Cabin's author. Why am I forgetting her name? You know what I mean. What's her name?
I'm drawing a blank as well.
I know. All right. We know who it is. He said the little lady that started the Civil War or something like that, And Orwell,
Harriet Beecher Stowe. Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, I'm getting old. But, you know, Orwell, of course. I mean, Orwell is mentioned more now in America than, you know, ever before. So with the House of God, I mean, and Sinclair Lewis, of course. With,
of course.
The Jungle. There are tons of them that are my models in a way. I think I'm different from them in that, you know, what really gets people, there are thousands of policy papers and thousands of speeches. What really, I'm so glad you said this, because what this book does is it's you there with your doctor with his back, and it gets you in your heart and it gets you in your gut. That's, you know, you don't learn too much of value in life if it's just through the head, right? So I am very happy. So I think that's going to happen because this is a book for patients, too. And I do think, as I say, the reason is that it hits you in an emotional way. And I wrote it in an emotional way. And the other thing is that one minute you're laughing, and then as Sanjay Gupta said from CNN, you know, you'll laugh out loud and then you'll cry because it's kind of both all the time as life is. I feel that, and I just will put in a word without getting, you know, wonky or anything like that. In some ways, it's very simple what will work. And that I, you know, I'm sort of allying with nurses and patients, too, to try to help lead this or advise this. The issue is that the machines that were originally designed for data and information transfer, somehow the insurance, the for-profit insurance agency got in there so that a code for a disease was equal to a certain cash for the insurance company, right? And that I don't know how that exactly happened, but what has to, so for instance, take the instance of appendectomy, a diagnosis code, right? What should happen is the doctor in the hospital on his screen says appendectomy. He clicks that, and that's it, because he's not going to argue about how much payment that is, because it's all basically the same all through a national healthcare system, whatever it is, Medicare, it doesn't matter. National healthcare system, not for profit. Appendectomy costs the same in New York as it does in Mississippi. Maybe a little more, a little less in Mississippi because they scale it. It's like the VA. That's what they do. The private insurance system, this is what I don't get about these candidates. The private insurance system can go on. You know, there's Medicare supplemental private insurance now that I have, and it works. They can go on, but with the requirement, and this is new, nobody's ever said this before, I mean, I'm saying it today, the private insurance industry can bill what it wants in additional for that appendectomy, but they can't bill it through the computer in the hospital that the doctors are working at. The doctors don't bill. Let them try to get the money out of other people, the private insurance industry, right? And that relieves this huge primal pressure, doctors, nurses, et cetera, who work at those screens from having to spend 60 or 70% of their time there because it's all about the billing. If you take out the billing, put it on the private insurance, go ahead, have fun. Here's the diagnosis of appendectomy. You get more money for it if you want more than we pay. You know? That's it.
Right. Well, the new book is... It does, absolutely. And I hate that we're out of time because there's so much more to talk about. But the book is called Man's Fourth Best Hospital, the direct sequel to The House of God. Samuel Shem, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today. I hope this book sparks a giant conversation about not only what's wrong with the healthcare system, but what we can do to help bring about a change. If people are just learning about you...
The change would be about what's right. It's a great system. It's just crippled right now.
Absolutely. If folks are just learning about you and want to find out more about all that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah. It's mansforthbesthospital.com with a numeral four. Mansforthbesthospital.com.
And like you mentioned earlier, there's a fantastic video on there where all of the folks that inspired the characters, where you get back together, and there's some really great insight in there. We're going to put a link to it in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
And you too. This has been great.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
I'm melting,
cried Joey.
Take the picture already.
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampirist in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang, "Choo-choo," as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
Jason, are you deaf?
Sorry. Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
Your turn.
No, thanks.
Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you.
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
Say chowder,
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
Come on, man. Say chowder.
Fine, chowder. Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.